Hey folks, it's Mike from Profiling Evil. I've been studying criminal behavior for more than 40 years, and one of my favorite research tools is Truth Finder. It's online, and you're not going to believe the information stored there. So if you want to know more about that new neighbor, your babysitter, or your online date, give Truth Finder a try. I'm including a special link below with special discount pricing, but you got to click the link and enter EVIL10 at checkout. Now, we're an affiliate, which means we get a small commission, but you can cancel at any time. Welcome to the Profiling Evil podcast. I'm Mike King, and during my law enforcement career, I investigated some of the most complex serial sex crimes imaginable. This episode is going to explore how law enforcement categorizes these complex crimes in a way that helps law enforcement solve them. I'll be talking with forensic psychologist Scott Johnson, who spent the last 20 years teaching police officers, FBI agents, and prosecutors about this unique set of typologies. It is an honor today to have with me Scott Allen Johnson, a licensed forensic psychologist. Scott, how are you doing?
I'm doing fine. Thank you very much for having me.
Oh, man, it's just my privilege, and I am so excited for everybody to hear some of the discussion that we're going to have today. Folks, Scott is recognized in forensic psychology globally. He's had more than 30 years of experience in this forensic field, where he addresses issues of sexual psychopathic personality types. He talks about abuse and sexual offenses and domestic violence issues. I think one of the things that I'm most thrilled about, Scott, is that you have nearly 20 years of experience providing instruction to law enforcement and to prosecutors in this field, specifically dealing with crimes of offender typologies and the investigation of these crimes from a forensic standpoint. With all of that, you continue to even teach at the academic level in colleges across the country, and you've authored a number of books. One that I think is really a pretty amazing work is When I Love You Turns Violent. Tell me a little bit about that book.
Well, I wrote that book so long ago, but still relevant today, but trying to address violence just more openly. And so, you know, looking at perpetrators and victims being male or female doesn't really matter, but trying to understand better how perpetrators act. So as we even educate victims through the book on how offenders think, it helps them, I think, cope better with what happened to them to make sense of the craziness. On the other hand, I've used the book also with perpetrators who helped gain an understanding of how perhaps their behavior wasn't so good. So it's an interesting book.
When we think about how you have evolved your profession over and started teaching law enforcement, what really precipitated that move and led you to want to provide more instruction to law enforcement directly?
Well, I think as we attempt to intervene with situations, it's important to understand somewhat the personality and the behaviors that we're likely to expect. And so as we intervene and look at perhaps identifying the motive of a specific crime, that might change how we question a person, whether we're more gruff or more gentle, kind of understanding where the offender was likely going with it. That also helps the officers deal better with the victim, because if they understand how the perpetrator was acting, what the perpetrator was likely saying and doing, et cetera, that might provide a different structure for how they question a victim to put the victim more at ease, but also to get the necessary information from the victim that we need. And so also on the perpetrator side, same thing. If we really want to talk about it, we have to understand their underlying motive better so that we can choose a behavior strategy that's likely to be more effective in a shorter amount of time.
You know, that's really interesting to me, because as an investigator, one of the things that I learned early on, especially when I started investigating crimes that involve sexuality, was that too often when a police officer goes into an investigation, they kind of want to do the whodunit, obviously. And we teach that it's so important to focus on the victim and the victimology, because that helps us better understand not only who the victim is, but why they became a victim. And when we start to understand why they became a victim, then it becomes a little easier when you're looking at this mass pool of possible suspects to start looking at who might be more probable based on the way in which they committed the offense and what really is motivating the offender. I mean, what really is turning on their motor and causing them to commit these kinds of crimes? When you think about these investigations, what are your thoughts along those lines?
I think that's very important to understand why a specific victim was chosen, as well as the location and how prepared or unprepared the offender was. Was the victim simply a circumstantial victim? They were at the right place, wrong time, or were they targeted? But what was done to the victim is important, because that helps us identify the motive, the true motive. Sex is rarely the motive, because most of the sexual offenders have consenting sex partners. So when we start adding violence to it, there's a reason for them. So understanding and listening to the victim is very important. What was said, but also what was not done, what was not said. So those might be some moral parameters of the offender. Of, for example, if they didn't punch the victim in the face, but they slapped the victim, that's going to show a restraint on the perpetrator's part, because they could have done more, but they chose not to. So the victim really is the beginning of understanding the offense and the offender.
You know, I really like that. And I like one example that you brought up in that description. And I remember when I was going through training to learn this art and science of profiling, was that it is as important what isn't done and what isn't said as what is said in these kinds of investigations. And it takes a real mind shift for an investigator to start looking at a case and saying, but what isn't being said here?
Exactly. And, you know, as much as sometimes we think perpetrators do not have morals, many do have a certain, I guess, wall of what they will not do. So as we start to narrow down potential suspects, are we looking for the wallflower in the room? Or are we looking for the boisterous idiot at the other end? Are we looking for confidence, not confidence? So, you know, and I think that's the easy piece we miss. Even forensic examiners may miss that part of why didn't they do more? Or why did they compromise when they didn't have to compromise? So I think listening is the big piece. And listening is like, you know, if you think about a medical examiner, they listen to the body. It's not talking, but it is talking. It's telling us things. And so victims tell us a lot if we listen, observe, and ask the right questions.
You know, the other thing that I think is so interesting when you start to examine a case and examine it, everything that happened more forensically, is that you start to look at even the order in which things happen, because they help us to better understand the fantasies that are going on in the mind of the offender. You know, why did they say not only do this, but say this? What are your thoughts there?
Well, I agree. And I think that as we think about how an offender conceptualizes in their head what they want to do, fantasy plays a significant role. And I think Roy Hazelwood and Ann Burgess really did a good job in their book, Practical Aspects of Rape Investigation, on a chapter on the fantasy and fantasy continuum. From some that have very intricate fantasies, like Jeffrey Dahmer, who, if things didn't go quite right, he stopped, versus someone that's just more impulsive and they have little planning to it. But the fantasy is a big part. And I think one of the tools we miss too much, especially in the forensic or treatment world of sexual predators or domestic violence people, is that we don't look at the pornography they use. We don't look at the, or for child molesters, the child sexually exploitive material that helps guide that fantasy. And so often in an interview, for example, where you've got someone that's likely to terminate that interview within 3 to 5 minutes, if we can hook them into how they got there, the fantasy part, the unexpected question of how did we get here, we oftentimes find that they start to tell us where they got the ideas that things were right. So, you know, the underlying thoughts and the motivation, that's where we come back to that is, again, they all have consenting sex partners, but why do they cross that line? Well, that's for non-sexual needs. And the fantasy part of that is so strong. That's a difficult thing even for those treating people is trying to get at, identify and change the fantasies that people have.
You know, that is interesting, and it reminds me of some of the serial sexual predators that I've investigated. And I remember learning early on from my mentors this concept of fantasy and that reality is never as cool as fantasy. And that's what drives these offenders to be repetitive in nature because let's say in the case of a child sexual abuser, they fantasize in their mind how this is all going to come off and how they're going to do it. But all of a sudden in the course of this assault, the child's curled up in a ball and, you know, asking for its mom, his mom and dad or her mom and dad. And the fantasy breaks down. Well, it doesn't stop the offender from completing the act sexually and continuing to abuse the child in many cases. But what I have seen is that they have to go back and repair the fantasy so they can try it once again. But it's never going to be enough. And so they keep trying over and over and over again to get to the fantasy.
Right. And, you know, we've all had fantasies of that vacation. And yet we get there and nothing goes the way we thought. But it was still a great vacation.
There you
right?
go.
We're flexible. And so with our offender population for deviant reasons are trying to replay this fantasy that they saw online. For example, much of the child pornography displays children enjoying things. Well, that's not the reality that we see. The rape sites, same thing. They sometimes show victims semi-enjoying something when in fact that's not at all what you know, there's no enjoyment. And so when people try to make fantasy reality, there's almost always going to be a flaw in it. But now that obsession piece starts in that they have to get back to what they wanted, which was a perfect offense that had perfect satisfaction that they practiced. I call it practice and premeditation. They practice with the pornography. They might practice on some consenting partners to some degree. And then they bring it to a victim who's not in the script. And therefore, how could the victim help it come to life the way the offender wanted it? Well, they can't. So the offender probably has always got some disappointment in what happened.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Why is it such a, difficult jump for people to accept the fact that sexual predators, when they go out and you know, let's say an opportunistic person goes out and assaults someone after they've met them in a bar, and yet we learn that they have a relationship at home, they're married, or they have a consenting partner that can help them sexually. This seems to be a really difficult thing for many people to understand that this isn't just about sex.
Right. And, you know, I think there's five underlying primary motives that we need to pay attention to. Now, some we've heard before: power, control, anger. And then we could certainly add for some revenge. And then I add prerogative. There's just simply some people that believe I have a right to do this, or the person, the victim, has to finish what might have been started in flirting with what they have in their fantasy. And so we tend to do a good job in our society of blaming victims. We certainly know that with jury trials, that jurors at times are more sympathetic for a perpetrator because they blame the victim for what he or she may have done that in the perpetrator's mind led them on, when in fact that was all part of the perpetrator's plan to begin with. They're cunning, conniving, planning, and if it doesn't go quite right, they're going to either act out with more anger or they're going to let it go for the night and wait till another day.
Yeah, that's really the difference, isn't it, between a legitimate pursuit of needs and this illegitimate need, pursuit that we see with predators is that they are not satisfied figuring out what they did wrong in their courting or in their relationship. And instead, they just say, no, by golly, I deserve this and I'm going to take it.
Exactly, exactly. And that could be twofold. Either A, they don't feel confident acting something out against their partner because they really don't want to hurt their partner, but they want to try it. Or B, they just find it too disgusting to do with the partner. So it's okay to do to someone else, but not to a loved one. You know, we see that if we just take basic prejudice and bias, well, that's really what it's about. Don't hurt my child, but let me hurt yours. And so seeking out that deviant situation, you know, the offenders, you know, sometimes, you know, they may practice with their consenting partners to a degree, but that doesn't quell the power or the control or the revenge or whatever other issues are going on in their head that are motivating it. Again, if they hurt their loved one at home, they may lose that loved one at home or may be more easily detected. So I think we miss that piece. They might be a loving spouse. They might be a great mom or dad. But at the same time, they've got that deviant side. I mean, if we just look at Jerry Sandusky, something public out there, what were their 30 years or more of complaints that never once made it to anything significant for discipline? Certainly no charges. And it's because we don't really want to believe victims at times. But the offenders can be also very schmoozy and cunning, and likable. And that's the other side of this, yeah. The likable part, right? It's easy when it's a monstrous looking, ugly person that doesn't offense, but that's not the average offender.
Boy, isn't that the truth that, and people of privilege, and I guess we could try to define privilege, seem to get away. We see that with things like even with what happened with Jeffrey Epstein and the saga that's going on with Brunel and Maxwell and others, that not only is there backing behind them to help through the legal processes, but they're charismatic and they're good at their public persona.
Exactly. And, you know, if we think about taking a case to trial, we're reliant on 6 to 12 jury members to make a decision. And we forget that jury members are just average people. They may or may not have any degrees. They're average people that got chose to judge a case that's appalling. And so it's easier to go with the person we like versus the truth at times, because it's just easier on our conscience. You know, I can't stand to see him go to prison. Well, he may have to go to prison. But so kind of reaching, you know, tugging on the heartstrings, you know, part of that problem is, do we hold people accountable for their behavior or do we not? And in our society, we have a hard time with that. We make excuses for some people to break the rules, but not others, not realizing that if you bend anywhere, it's going to bend everywhere. And so the offenders have that going for them. They often look good. They have friends. And then maybe there's friends that could be implicated in similar situations. So, of course, they're going to defend that person to the hilt so that they don't get implicated in something that happened. And we see that a lot at party situations where we might have 5, 10, 20 other people at the party that knew darn well what was going on, but nobody intervened. And so even with the Epstein and similar things, there's a lot of sideliners, too, that may be implicated. So people just don't want to believe it. They protect the perpetrator over the truth.
Yeah. Isn't that a tragedy? We victimize the victims again, even in the criminal justice system as part of all of this process. And yet it's almost a necessity that we do that to ensure that we're also protecting the rights of someone and not convicting them before there's been a trial.
Correct. Sometimes it's easy to jump to that public sentiment of guilt or innocence, but it takes that assessment that investigation process to get to the bottom of it. And some people don't have patience for that. They prejudge.
You talked about Roy Hazelwood and Ann Burgess, and I had the opportunity of coming to know Ann as I did some studies with my mentor and friend, Greg Cooper. And we studied some cases of sexual predators who particularly focused on the elderly as part of the victim selection process that they went through. Dr. Burgess was kind enough to ensure that we became visiting scholars at Boston College, and I've tracked her work for years and years, and I've learned so much from her. I based my understanding of offender typologies on Hazelwood's work and the work that was done by the profiling unit at the behavioral science unit at the FBI, namely the breakdown of offender characteristics and categories by looking at them in four basic areas: the power reassurance, the power assertive. I think we called it then the anger retaliatory, and then the anger excitation rapist. But you've actually taken this further as you have incorporated your experience and studies, and you've added to that list, and you've also started to kind of make some adjustments. Could you kind of walk me through that process that you did professionally as you made some of those mind change adjustments?
Well, being in the psychology field, that's where much of the research started. And so looking at the work of Prentke and Knight and Jean Abel and others, we started to have typologies that bled over to the BSU unit. We share information. And so I think I was just fascinated that can we actually categorize these for a better understanding, maybe as we investigate better, ask better questions for a specific type of offender. And if you think about treatment, then it shouldn't be a cookie cutter program because the dynamics are different for the different typologies. So I found probably a third of the people fit neatly into categories, but some have a primary category, which they act out the majority of the time. And yet on occasion, maybe because of a different motive, for example, maybe they're not physically violent with the victim the majority of the time, right? Power reassurance rapist. But then once in a while, anger takes over and they might have one or two offenses a year that were very much an anger-based rape. And so for me, the typologies are an important understanding for how to better get grips of the offense, how to intervene with the victim, and how to deal with the perpetrator. But the underlying goal, of course, is the motive, which has to dictate them. So it's fascinating as we get into this. Yeah.
From my standpoint, I always looked at these typologies as a way to better understand the offender so that I could do a better job in interviewing. And I really leaned upon those typologies as a way to also kind of classify or put into buckets on multiple sexual assaults who the offender might be, that these are all having very similar characteristics and the way in which the assaults are being conducted is very similar. So I think that they fit this kind of personality type. As you've taken this further from a psychologist perspective, what have I missed along the way there?
Well, nothing missed, but I would certainly add that there's always a caveat somewhere. So if we think about the opportunistic category, and I know, the person who starts out to do a different crime and then has an opportunity and therefore decides to commit a rape, child molestation, whatever, but it was really a spur of the moment decision. So the opportunistic person who may not have put much of any planning in it, just more impulsive, if we think more sociopathic in that, maybe they're just more boasting and fly by the seat of their pants, if you will. So sometimes there's that opportunistic offender who simply, you know, makes a decision whether or not they continue to do it or how often they do it. Maybe not often at all. But so the opportunistic piece. certainly is one, but the motive, I think, is more important in the sense that that kind of guides where we're going. So we might have someone that's kind of caught in between two different typologies, if you will. So someone that's more power reassurance might also have some power or anger issues that get demonstrated as well. So again, not neatly fitting in. I think so flexibility to me is what we need, so we don't get overly cocky and miss something, because arrogance is our enemy.
Yeah, I really like that. And it makes me think back. And again, I put so much on what I learned when I was going through that profiling process of training. But I remember, again, my mentor often saying, he who is good with a hammer thinks everything is a nail. And that it is so dangerous to think that because I saw this once before, it's the exact same person, the exact same personality type, the exact kind of motivation that I saw in these other cases. These really just become kind of rudders in the storm to keep getting us closer and closer to who the offender is.
Correct. And I think to be more humble, I think one way that I became more expert in the field was I listened to the offender. And as we see strategies evolved over the years where theme development for helping us structure that maybe will go along with the offender's way of thinking in an interview to blame the victim short term so that we get the offender to explain to us why they did it. And you have to have some humility there because you don't know where they're going with it. And so if we always keep an open mind, that's the biggest piece. Because, of course, we always work just as hard to exonerate the innocent as we do to help convict the guilty. And the only way to do that is really listening and sorting it out, because what looks like one thing might be another thing.
You know, I think that is so important. And it's really an interesting thing when you think about how the offender evolves and becomes an offender. Many, for instance, of rapists that I've visited with talk about how they started with things like window peeking, simple burglaries. And I'd like you maybe just to talk about that transition that occurs when they are doing the window peeking and other things. And of course, they introduce fantasy when they do that. And that propels maybe more egregious kinds of assaults later down the road. But then maybe if you could talk about, does it mean if I start at one level of a typology or offender typology that I'm going to progress through the ranks to the more violent kind? Help us understand why there isn't or is progression through the ranks.
Start with the last question first. Because we start at point A, does that mean we'll get to D? Absolutely not. There are some that simply get stuck where they're at, or perhaps try something a couple times, realize it's wrong, and stop. There's always that slim number of people that learn pro-social from what they did to not do it again, right? Now, the majority, however, are getting reinforced for it. And if we get away with it, number one, that is reinforcement if we're not held accountable for something. So if we start adding power, control, revenge, prerogative, whatever to motive, if we start out window peeping, that's a pretty powerful event. You're spying on people who have no idea you're there, but watching intimate details, showering, dressing, sexual contact, whatever. All people who voyeur are not going to become rapists or burglaries. We understand that. But we've got too many that do. And the idea of looking outside of a window, reinforcing that with two things. One is not getting caught, and masturbation, which is a great reinforcer, means that we're probably going to do it again and again and get a little more sophisticated. And then that train of thought again goes to the next level of planning where, well, what if I were in the house? I don't want to touch anyone. What if I was in the house? So we get the person who hides in the closet or hides in another room but doesn't do anything else and leaves. Problem is, you do that, you get away with it, you've just reinforced that thought, of that power, right? So the odds of you increasing it exponentially increased with each step forward, because you're already demonstrating that it's not enough. Now, the other side of that is there's the one thing you can never predict, which is victim reaction. So someone decides to burgle and just watch with no intent of touch at that time. All of a sudden, the victim's aware of and starting to fight. Now you've got a whole different situation that the perpetrator may not have planned for. And there we could see, of course, an exponential increase in violence and things like that, because the offender wants to get away. So it's not a black and white science there, but we certainly know that people start out early. There's no gene, no genetics for sex offenders. There's no gene or genetics for child molestation. We know sexual orientation has a gene. There's other things that have genes. But we see more of a learning theory progression for people that start at point A and end up at rape or child molestation or pimping or whatever it is that they do. So it's typically the progression, the learning, the experience, the reinforcing, the deviant. So, of course, people that start out with voyeurism, exhibitionism, frauderism, grabbing the quick feel, the upskirt camera shots, for many, that's just the tipping point where they need to go the step further to keep the same excitement. And then, of course, the online supply of deviant material to support that interest doesn't help.
That is, has been something that has really troubled me. And I hear particularly from articles of reaction from the porn industry or others that it doesn't impact. But tell me, I mean, just your gut check. Have we seen an increase in sexual predation as a result of this increase in availability of pornography, like things through the internet?
Well, I would say absolutely. And the proof of that is, for the competent people, forensic assessment people on one side or law enforcement, the competent people that ask the offender about how did they get there, to ask directly what porn sites were you on, right? We actually get more data forward acknowledging how that was a building block for the majority of our offenders. And so when people talk about child porn offenders or child, the users of child sexually exploitative material offenders, that somehow that's the cap for them, as long as they can look at it online. Well, the reality is that research strongly supports that 50 to 85% of those users of the child porn, if you will, admit having numerous undetected victims. And so if all you do is ask them, but don't do polygraph or voice stress or something to verify their claim, for example, that I've never touched a person, or a person that's collecting rape porn, but we want to know how that related to them committing a rape, you know, polygraph's important. So I think the more available the material, the more likely we get people that can now validate that what they're doing is okay. Because if they can find it online, well, then it must be an okay thing. Plus, you add anonymity to it, right? You're not inviting everyone over to say, hey, look what I'm looking at. So you start to isolate more and seek out that material. And the bottom line for me is, if you're looking at deviant material, whether it's rape, child molestation, what have you, you're strengthening the deviant thought. And you can't argue that strengthening a deviant thought doesn't increase the likelihood of acting on it. Of course it does. It's called habituation. It's called learning theory. It's called practice makes perfect. So, you know, in my opinion, it doesn't help. Now, that doesn't mean everyone that goes to the porn sites are on deviant sites. There's certainly a heck of a lot of pornography that's feminist-based, relationship-based, not force-based. But if you've got that mindset to go look for other stuff, it's there.
Yeah. And my experience has been that the kind of pornography they're viewing is going to be reflected in the kind of and the methodology or steps taken in the assaults that they're involved in. Would you agree or disagree with that?
100%. In one of my articles on child sexual offenders, I actually looked at the data for that. And so if we think about how people get to a grooming or even a blitz attack of a child, the pornography seems to help build that confidence and give ideas. And as we look at it and look at it and look at it online and practice it and reinforce it with masturbation, we get more confidence. And so I don't know how you separate the two. If you took the pornography offline, would that eliminate sexual predators? No. Certainly, there's other forms of child pornography or sexually exploitive material, things like that. But I think it does make a difference. And if we listen to the experts, Jeffrey Dahmer, Bundy, I forget the man's name, I'm blanking right now, out of Ohio, who had the three females in the basement. They all talked about, I forget his name. That's probably a good thing. But they all talked about how the pornography led them to want to try new things. And interestingly enough, a lot of it back then was not internet. I mean, Bundy, Gacy, a lot of them, it was just paper products or
it was going to the adult bookstore. You're right.
Right. Right. So, you know, again, practice makes perfect. If you're masturbating to pornography that's about relationships and consent, good for you, because that's pro-social. But if we're looking at things where people are crying or pain or suffering, rape, etc., it's just strengthening the deviant arousal.
You know, folks, I'm talking with Scott Johnson, a forensic psychologist. And Scott, I am just so engrossed with this discussion. I started thinking as you were just talking about the child predator, about a serial predator that I got a confession from. I ultimately used him to train law enforcement. I took him, and actually while he was still in prison, I got permission to put him in a state-owned airplane, and we flew him to other jurisdictions and held training sessions so that the predator could talk about his victim selection process, the way in which he got away with this. And the training was just incredible. But here's why I'm even yammering about this is what happened is when he died, he willed everything that he had, his diaries and everything else, from 30 years in prison to me. And I didn't know this. The warden called and said, "You're the closest next of kin he has, so he wants you to have all of his property." But what it was a treasure trove of a deviant thought processes. And what I found in there were notations where he said throughout, he claims he had more than 500 children victims during his reign of terror. And one thing that he said was that he spent 8 hours a day in deviant thought and pornography perusal as part of all of this. And as I was going through the documents that he had in the prison, I was flabbergasted, and I called the warden and I said, "How on earth did you allow him to keep this in his possession?" He was cutting out images of the copper tone girl with her underwear being tugged by the dog, if you remember that old image, and keeping that in his diary. And that was his pornography in prison as he continued to fantasize and go through this process.
Yeah, I mean, it's just interesting how, you know, the new term is child sexually exploitive material, which can include not just child pornography, but props and underwear. And I've heard so many treatment professionals say, well, if they can masturbate to a pair of underwear, that keeps them from reoffending. And yet masturbating to the little boy or girl's underwear is unequivocally reinforcing the sexual attraction of children. So I kind of get frustrated even with my own field that there's so many that are trying to minimize the CSEM kind of material. Like, it's okay if they possess and masturbate to little boy, little girl underwear, when in fact they're a convicted child molester. And The research that comes out to support it, by the way, is always flawed because then they ask questions about, well, did you offend? Did you ever touch another child? No, but they don't do polygraph or voice stress or anything to really give us an objective measure of have they reoffended again or have they offended if we just catch them with the material, right? In fact, one of the lead researchers, Dr. Sito, out in California now, is really putting out a lot of, in my opinion, junk research that says that the those that are child porn only offenders really aren't a danger to anyone. They rarely, if ever, act out, even though he was part of the study that showed 50% of them were admitting having undetected touch victims. So I think politics are kind of coming around here to kind of give more rights. You have the right on probation to masturbate, to underwear, to toys, to clothed pictures of kids. Well, that supports your deviant arousal. So,
absolutely.
You know, we struggle
like
with this all the time. You know, it's called erotica, right? It's anything exactly. that you find sexually arousing. Well, even someone who's not a sex offender could fantasize about their spouse or partner dressed, getting undressed. Well, of course, right? But then when we start adding the deviant theme to it, and everyone starts to accept it, or probation officers can't take that stuff away, and then they're surprised at some point when there's a reoffense. Well, you know, but so sometimes we have too many rights.
This is so amazing, and I can't believe how fast the time is going by, Scott. I want to just ask you something as we kind of tie together a couple of things we've discussed. And this is something that I've wondered for many, many years. And that is, as we look at crimes in the juvenile court system, and I want to go right back to let's talk window peeking, which seems to be one of those that we see a lot in juvenile court. Are we putting enough emphasis on counseling and diversive kinds of therapies at that stage, or are we allowing this to become a blooming problem?
Oh, it's a blooming problem. But here's the thing. I mean, you've got a new field where we're actually trying to hold younger people accountable for adult crimes, right? And so there's theories about how people come about to be sexual predators, and everyone that's got any credibility is about environment, learning experiences, reinforcement. So it's not a biology per se. It's really a learned experience for whatever reason. And so when we think about intervening, do you have people who are actually trained in sexual predators, or do you just have the Yahtzee who happens to be the only provider for 50 miles who I'm the therapist, but I've got no training? And so when we start to think about how we assess children consistently, or adolescents, and treat them consistently, that's a big problem. We don't want to lock kids up. Well, evil exists. And if we've got someone engaged, I mean, I did one of my articles is on the school shootings that we've had in our countries. And I was just appalled that the biggest problem was mental health professionals would not civilly commit the kids for longer term assessment and treatment. With all their pathology that was documented, with all of the school and police interventions, the psychiatrists and psychologists just kept letting them go home, doing a 1 or 3 hour interview. Well, when we talk about significantly high risk behavior, sexual death, whatever, right? The high risk behaviors, oftentimes these children and adolescents, and maybe even adults, need that civil commitment because they need to be out of their environment and into a safe environment. And if we've got families that are pathological, they're not going to stop this kid from acting out. In fact, they may be one of the reasons the kid chooses to act out. But even if you've got a healthy family, if you've got antisociality or some psychopathy, that means there's limited ability at that young age to actually significantly intervene. We're talking personality wiring. So unfortunately, we need to probably do more inpatient or secured assessment and treatment for kids, because it is a problem. We keep letting them off, and then we see some of these 20 to 25-year-old offenders with just the most worst offenses, but we actually saw the red flags at age 11, 12. And we did nothing because you got bleeding heart people who say, well, they'll outgrow it, or you got to just reparent them, or, well, things that have no research behind them. It's just gobbledygook.
Such a difficult and complex problem when we talk about it. What point do you intervene, and what level do you intervene? Scott, will you please come back? We haven't even touched on the different offender typologies. What we've covered today, I think, has been just riveting. And I'd like to be able to come back and dive into each of those individually and talk about some of the offender characteristics. But I hope you'll come back.
All right, I will. I really appreciate this, Mike. It's been a great time here. It's nice to talk the facts. And so thank you for having me.
So, folks, we've been talking with Scott Allen Johnson, a forensic psychologist who has an incredible background, 30 years of experience in the seat in therapy and counseling of deviant behaviors, also 20 years of being able to work with law enforcement and prosecutors across the country. Scott, you have a website. Where can we direct people so that they can get more information about the work you've done?
Certainly, it's forensicconsultation.org. One word, forensicconsultation.org. And there's a publication page that you can go to see some of my writings and check me out.
That's great. And for law enforcement and folks, you might be interested anyway, but for law enforcement, you also have some downloads of some basic checklists for the offender typologies. Great tool, I think, for any police officer to be able to understand at a high level how to quickly start looking at those kinds of classifications. I want to get you back. We'll go into those typologies in detail. And I know that I'm going to have demands from people to get you back. So thank you so much for taking time today. And folks, I hope that you will subscribe, hit the notification button at Profiling Evil so that you get updates on things like this. And we'll look forward to the next podcast when we get together with Scott. Scott, thanks a lot.
Thank you again for having me.
Thanks for listening to the Profiling Evil podcast. If you enjoyed the show, don't forget to rate us and review us wherever you get your podcasts. And please, don't forget to go to our YouTube channel where you can watch some of the hundreds of videos we've created. Now, if you're looking for a great crime story, check out my new book, Deceived, an investigative memoir of the Zion Society cult. You can find it at profilingevil.com. While you're there, you can also sign up for our elite newsletter, The Bolo. I'm Mike King, and thanks for listening. Hey folks, it's Mike from Profiling Evil. I've been studying criminal behavior for more than 40 years, and one of my favorite research tools is TruthFinder. It's online, and you're not going to believe the information stored there. So if you want to know more about that new neighbor, your babysitter, or your online date, give TruthFinder a try. I'm including a special link below with special discount pricing, but you got to click the link and enter EVIL10 at checkout. Now, we're an affiliate, which means we get a small commission, but you can cancel at any time.